Which is, we moved into the book of Daniel now. If you've been with us for a while, our church, we've been going through the Old Testament, actually. There's a couple reasons why we wanted to go through the Old Testament. One was I realized people who are fairly new Christians may not know a lot of the amazing stories of God throughout the years and throughout the Bible. The other part is sometimes we forget actually how the Old Testament is also part of God's story for us. And so we've been kind of going through that. We just finished up Jeremiah, and we just looked at a couple chapters. But now we're going to spend the next month looking at the book of Daniel. I was looking through my old sermon notes and trying to figure out if I've preached on Daniel before. And I actually don't think I have, which is surprising because it's actually a very straightforward sermon. And if I don't have time, I should probably be able to pump this out really quickly. However, that's not what I did in this case. Just if you're wondering, for those of you who saw me work on it yesterday, I did just go home and just pump it out like that. But I remember when we were picking out these sermon topics, I thought, you know, actually Daniel is remarkably applicable and practical for us today, especially for those of us who are in the working world, actually. And it's interesting because it's like the kind of conflicts or the struggles that he goes into really challenges us. Thank you. Birmingham's finest. Okay. So if you guys recall, what we're talking about in Daniel is... Oh, good, it's the right one. Stop. He's doing a dance. I think it's S Club. He's saying, no, don't want. So what's happened here is this is probably the first Babylonian exile. And so... the king has sent people, and he's taken the best people. He's actually exiled. He's taken a whole bunch of people out of Judah and taken them away. And he said, okay, look, here's the deal. Go and find the best people. All right. So actually, if you've got your Bibles, turn to Daniel. If you don't have a Bible, you can raise your hand, and we'll have some people bring somebody. You just raise your hand above the plane of your head, and I'll read this out to you. That's awkward. This is sacred space. You can't just come on up here like that, Jay. Just right, so we're looking at Daniel chapter 1. So let me read this out. During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave him victory over Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects from the temple of God. So Nebuchadnezzar took them back to the land of Babylonia and placed them in the treasure house of God, of his God. First of all, very interestingly is, number one, Nebuchadnezzar, this foreign god, this foreign ruler, comes and takes stuff out of Jerusalem. And it says here very clearly, the Lord gave him victory over King Jehoiakim. Now, this is a big deal because back then, if you were a ruler of a nation, you were considered a god. Nebuchadnezzar would be a god. He had people worship him like a god. You'll see this later in Daniel where they make a statue and say, no one can pray to except for you. And the idea was whoever is in power must be a god because he is the one who wields that power. But interestingly enough, here in this book, the Bible doesn't say King Jehoiakim is God or anything like that. He says God lets Nebuchadnezzar come and besiege Jerusalem. In other words, God overarches all of the kings and the political structures in this world. Which immediately after praying for Hong Kong and China, we have an immediate understanding, wait, so you're saying God is still in control over what's happening here. And for us on an earthly level, we look at these things and think, but that's injustice. How could God allow his people to be attacked by a foreign person to take stuff out of the temple? That is not right. And yet here it says that God allowed that to happen. You begin to understand that we have on our earthly level an understanding of justice. In terms of what we see wrong done to one another. And we see that level and think that is injustice. If I go and punch someone in the face and, you know, they just sit there and cry because I punch so weakly. No, you would look at that and say, Bert, you're being really unjust. You just hit them for no reason. You could identify that. And that is true. God sees that too. But there seems to be a deeper level of life, of history that we don't understand, where God looks at things on another level when he looks at the history of the world and kings and rulers and says, what you think is justice of what's happening here is not what you think. Because we learn later what God is doing is he's teaching Israel and Judah a lesson. He's teaching his people who he is. He's teaching his people, even through this exile, of what a faithful God he is. In other words, sometimes these lessons take time, years, decades. And I think if you have children, you understand this very well, where your child demands something and then says, "You're so unfair." And they, in other words, there is a great injustice placed upon me because I am not allowed to go play, but I'm forced instead to practice piano. This is an injustice against humanity. My fear is that one day my child will sit and occupy the living room and say, "No one can have this space because until there is justice, I demand this family to be a democracy." Which would be bad. That's why you don't have three children, by the way. Because you would always lose in the family democracy if you have three children. The votes are equal. Okay, right. But that's fine. Obviously, if you have three children, God bless you. Three or more. every week I say something that I'm like, oh, that's all people are going to remember this week. Don't have more than two children. Right. So you have this idea where actually the child's perspective is, that is injustice to me because I should be allowed to do this. And you see this more and more throughout modern society, actually, because we're becoming a more me-focused society. When you become a more and more me-focused society, when someone does a wrong to you, you feel that there is injustice being done. But as a parent, you know that, look, the reason you're not being allowed to play is has nothing to do with justice. It has everything to do with understanding or learning or growing or becoming the person you need to become. I know, because I grew up many years later and sitting around the table with my parents, I said, "I wish you guys were stricter with me when I was growing up. That's how I'm going to raise my children, stricter." And my parents just looked at me and said, "You think it's so easy to be strict? You're so stubborn, and we just had to give in." So I was like, oh, interesting. I thought, well, that bodes well for me as a parent, until I realized my children are more stubborn than me. So, right, so very cool. And then we start realizing, okay, well, what God is doing here is not necessarily about justice, but about relationship, about learning. And when we start looking at the things that are going on in the world, it doesn't mean that you don't pray for God's justice to be there or for God's mercy to be in those places, because we still cry out there because we see on a personal level things being done wrong. But then on a greater level, you start saying, God, I trust that you know what you're doing. And I still cry out for peace. Because this is what's happening for these guys as well. They're being exiled. They're taken away. There's political turmoil for them. But they are still crying out to God for peace, for justice, for mercy, for forgiveness, for all these things. So here we go. And it's pretty crazy because Nebuchadnezzar basically ransacks stuff from the temple and he takes it back. And this is a big deal. This is like taking the most precious artifacts and saying, well, I've got them. They're my booty now. I'm going to keep them. So reading on verse 3, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. Select only strong, healthy, and good-looking men, he said. Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning, are gifted with knowledge and good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and literature of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar, Babylonians were pretty brutal. Not as brutal as the Assyrians, but pretty brutal still. And he's got this great idea. Let's take the best people out of the land and train them up in our culture. We'll take the young best people and essentially we'll brainwash them so that they will feel Babylonian, because then we can use them in the government. It's the equivalent of them being labeled as high flyers, and so they're fast-tracked to a great education. They're given the best food from the king's table. They're treated preciously, and especially not as prisoners, and they're saying, look, this is because we're going to raise you up, and you're going to work, and we're going to trust you in these areas. Now, this is a great way to actually build loyalty. When you are up into that kind of level, you can't. It's really hard to break away, isn't it? It's hard to say, well, I'm just going to quit my job, and I'm just going to go back to my own people. Because you're so secure in where you've moved up. Verse 5 says, the king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for 3 years, and then they would enter the royal service. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. The chief of staff renamed them with these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belteshazzar, Hananiah was called Shadrach, Mishael was called Meshach, Azariah was called Abednego. And then verse 8. But Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. And this is the heart of this story, is actually this moment where Daniel says something different. Now, he's being offered the best of the king's table, which means wine. It probably means really meat, probably means maybe pork. And at this point, Daniel, who is Jewish, is probably saying, well, I probably shouldn't eat these things. But my question is, why does Daniel protest the food? Why doesn't he protest something else? Why doesn't he protest the education? Why doesn't he say, I don't want to learn your evil, demonic laws and governance, because this is not right, this is not for my kingdom? Why doesn't he protest a Sabbath? Why doesn't he protest, well, I don't believe I should have to, I should do any work on the seventh day, because God decreed that holy? Why doesn't he say, well, I shouldn't even be in the same room with you as a foreigner? This is not right. Why does he choose to protest food? What you begin to understand is, actually, there must have been something in Daniel's relationship with God where this was the one that stood out. The first point that I'm going to try and make about this is that you learn to live God in small ways. What we see here, first of all, is Daniel saying, look, this is food. For some of us, it's not a big deal. For others, it is. For the Jewish people, it is a big deal. Because actually, there's something called kosher. You're not supposed to eat certain kind of foods. And so Daniel actually requests then, well, just give me a strictly vegan diet. He doesn't say vegan, because that word's not around then. He basically says, you know, no meat, no wine. And because this reflects kind of the stuff in the Bible, which means, like, don't drink wine, don't get drunk on these things, don't take the kind of meat. So he's like, well, I'm a foreign place. This is what I'm going to decide. But the key word here is Daniel was determined not to. There was a solidarity in his spirit where he knew that this was wrong, that this was the thing he was going to stand up for. He could have protested a million different things, actually, and yet this is the one that he chooses. Well, how do we know Daniel's not just crazy? What if suddenly I decided that I'm just going to wake up and I'm going to protest as well? I'm going to say, well, I think it's wrong to do this. And I'm just going to make up something and just say, well, I found it in the Bible and I think it's wrong. And that's the conviction that I have. We see actually in this part that actually Daniel doesn't do this on his own. That there's a process here. There's learning that's done. And the first thing that you see is actually there's corroboration with other believers. Daniel doesn't just go up to the chief of staff himself and protest. But he goes with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. In other words, these four guys had discussed this already. And this is an important thing, because it means that actually when we are struggling to understand what God's will for us is in our life is, when we're struggling to know what to stand up for, that it's important to find other brothers and sisters in faith and to ask them, what do you think about this? Daniel was the spokesperson, but this was a collective. The four brothers together said, well, they're not really brothers, but the four brothers out there together said, look, you're right. I have that same conviction. Maybe Daniel was the first one who started it, but you begin to see how important it is to have community. When we begin to understand that this is taking place in exile, you begin to understand what God is teaching his people. God is teaching his people that even though you are in a foreign land, you are among people who don't believe the same thing as you, you need to meet together with those who do know you, who do know God, so that you can discuss, so that you can share, that you can be part of each other's lives, so that you don't wander off and just be crazy on your own. There's a fellowship there. Well, the second thing that happens is Daniel asks the chief of staff. Now, he doesn't just suddenly sit down and do a hunger protest, which is very popular in prisons nowadays. He doesn't just start a fight, but he actually asks the chief of staff. In other words, there's a politeness, a humility almost in this process. Okay, let's keep thinking back. So wait, but actually Daniel's determined. He's so sure that this is the right thing to do. He's checked with those other guys. They all feel this is the right thing to do. But they still go by it step by step. He doesn't just say to the chief of staff, well, we've decided this is not right. You know, we're not like you people. He asks them and says, you know, and let's see. In verse 8, he asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. Well, that's a big step of faith, actually. It's that moment where you actually have to pause and say, well, I'm going to see. If God, if you close this door, what will I do next? I don't know. But actually, God doesn't close the door. Verse 9 says, now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel, but he responded, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has ordered you to eat this food and wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths your age, I'm afraid the king will have me beheaded. And Daniel spoke with the attendant who had been appointed to the chief of staff to look after Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Please test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetables and water, Daniel said. In other words, then he does the third thing. So the first thing is he got together with people and he corroborated. And he said, well, let's have fellowship. Do we have unity in this decision? Second thing, he asks. He asks those in charge and says, well, look, this is the thing. And then the guy's like, well, I don't want to get killed. So he says, well, then test. And he puts the thing to a test for 10 days. Any serious decision you're coming to, these are great steps to do, actually. Check with your brothers and sisters. Ask God. Knock on the doors and see if whether they open or they shut. And even in this 10 days, there's a bit of, well, in this case, negotiation with the staff. He said, look, just test us for 10 days and see. I have a feeling that actually Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they knew that they would be better if they trusted God. So for them, this wasn't a test. It wasn't testing God for them. They were demonstrating to the people, to the chief of staff, that their God was reliable. It was this small step of faith. All of these happened little bit by little bit. Sometimes we think to get our way across, we've just got to bang down the door or smash it through. But actually, step by step, increment by increment, you actually see this change happen. We begin to understand that actually the life that we're living is a process that unfolds bit by bit. And the things that we're doing to make a change sometimes just takes little steps by little steps. The key is to trust God and follow Him and live God in little steps, in little ways every day. Well, the second thing that we see about Daniel is that he actually worships with his life. So the decision not to eat this food is part of Jewish culture. It's actually one of God's laws, right? So he's trying to hold to that. And for Daniel, one of the reasons he decides to do this is because it's his way of continuing to worship God. Up until this point, they would go to the temple, they would sacrifice animals, they would worship God in that way. All that was taken away. He's got no more temple. He does nothing to take to someone to slaughter. He has no way to continue to identify himself as a believer of God. So this eating, this decision to eat, this was also his way of worshiping. Why? Why this way? Why not like the Sabbath? Because this was his body. In other words, he's saying, my body, God, is used for you. My body is for your kingdom. Use me in your way. And that's a challenge for us because we have to ask ourselves, well, actually, God, do we decide to honor God with our bodies? With our physical life, with our actions, with who we are. If you pay attention to other aspects of Christianity, Daniel becomes a very popular diet plan as well. I think Rick Warren actually has one called the Daniel Plan. And I looked it up, and I thought to myself, why are you laughing? Are you suggesting something? I looked it up, and I thought, oh, so basically the idea is that it runs through small groups. And his big thing is that it takes faith and accountability and this kind of fellowship, and then they also diet together. And it's the idea of kind of eating more vegetables and less meat. And I thought, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. But the bigger picture out of that is this idea of, Well, actually, God, with my body, may it be glorifying to you. May I worship you with this, with what I eat, with how I live, with what I do with it. When we begin to think about that more, it begins to challenge us in areas of consuming a lot of alcohol or smoking or premarital sex. You start to question even the things that you're doing. You're saying, well, actually, God, how can I honor you with my life? How can I honor you with my body? Worship with his whole life. He said, look, I trust that if I do this, God, if I worship you in this way, that things are going to work out. Maybe I'm not going to do well, but I know that I am following you. The amazing thing is God actually transforms this and ends up using it for some greater stuff. The third point I want to point out is there is political, managerial conflict going on here. So this is where it really relates to a work situation. The chief of staff, okay, this is my main point. Daniel, for some reason or another, in his character and his relationship with the people, other students, and with the chief of staff was good. It says here that actually God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. But you understand that it's not just God zapping the chief of staff, but there is a relationship there. In other words, the way Daniel conducted himself, continually, you're guessing, reflecting God in those aspects, meant that through this process, he had a relationship or a connection. In other words, favor from the chief of staff. Now, it could have gone the other way, couldn't it? Daniel could have been upset and grumpy that he was there. He could have been frustrated. He could have been indignant. He could be like, well, I don't want to do this. I didn't want to be exiled here anyways. You know, I don't have to talk to these people. Yeah, he doesn't. And this turns out to be a big deal because if you look at this in terms of employee-manager situation, he is essentially an employee under, he's bonded to the government for his education is what's happening here. And yet he is treating his supervisor with respect, with compassion, and I think that's among his peers as well. And meanwhile, the chief of staff is the kind of manager who's just a middleman. He's middle management. There is a supervisor above him, and he's like, if I do this, I'm totally going to lose my head, which literally he would. He would be killed. If you know anything about management structure, the middleman or middle manager is the most frustrating place because you have pressure from the top trying to challenge you to push the other people into a direction, even though it might not make any sense. It could be the worst plan ever, but you don't have any choice. You have to implement this. And we talk about this in particular, with the council, because there's so many more cuts coming. It's like, well, how is the work actually going to get done? And the people in the middle say, well, we don't know, but we have to make these cuts. This is just the way it's going to go. And as that happens, there obviously can be more and more fear, more and more frustration, more and more pressure. But look at Daniel's life. He never lets this get to him. Why? How does he not let this get to him? How does this pressure not get to him? How does it get to the point where he can actually ask for something more in this kind of situation? It's because he is not focused on what's happening in Babylon. He's not focused on his life just in that small pocket. He is seeing God above all else. He knows that he's here because of what God is doing. He knows that he will leave or die by God's hand. And so for him, the most important thing is to remain faithful to God, to worship him, to serve him well. And without him even realizing, he's following the greatest commandments, actually, which is to love God with all your heart. And he's doing that by the way he's choosing to eat. And love his neighbor, you know, the chief of staff. Well, it's actually not even the chief of staff. It's also the attendant who had been appointed by the chief of staff. he goes to middle management and to the middle management below him. So his direct line manager, he talks to you as well. In other words, you see a great relationship he has with all these people. Now, this is probably the biggest challenge for us who are employees. Part of it is, how much do we fight for? How much do we speak out against? And how much do we submit and be patient with? Anyone who knows what it's like to work, it feels like it's impossible to know which one's the right thing to do, what the right decision is, because there are so many options, so many choices, so many problems. But when you stop and you ask God and say, actually, God, you give me your wisdom to show me what it is that I should speak up for and what is okay. And then you check with other coworkers, what do you think about this? Or other brothers and sisters in church, and say, look, I'm thinking about this and about bringing this up in work. This is my situation. What do you think? And then you pray, and then you test, and you knock the door, and you go to your manager and say, hey, what do you think about this? And your manager means, like, yeah, if I did that, I'd just get fired right away. And then you stop and you think, well, maybe I can test. Maybe I can test this in another way. You begin to understand that actually there are ways forward in the systems that we're locked into now, and it's not hopeless. God instigated probably the most amazing grassroots movement you could ever see. And he did it, first of all, with the birth of the Jewish people. And he did it a second time with his disciples. And he begins to demonstrate, look, the grassroots movements instigated by God work because God is at the head. And he is teaching us and navigating and showing us what to do and how to work. Now, the flip side of this is you're a manager, actually. Okay, so some of you guys are higher up. You're actually in middle management. Maybe you're the boss of your own company. And you're like, well, actually, what you're learning here is humility and your relationship with your employees. If you've ever had a great manager, you understand how amazing it is to work with them, what a difference it makes in your workplace. It's something where we begin to be challenged. Well, God, if you lead me to this place in the future, let me be prepared for that, to know how to listen, to be humble, to have good relationships with my employees, to see the bigger picture, actually, that God is still teaching us about greater things. Now, for a lot of you students who have now zoned out because you're like, oh, he's talking about work, you will all experience this later. Or else. But you might also experience it in your own groups, especially during group projects, which are the most painful things you will ever experience in university level, because no one has any real motivation because no one's getting paid. So you will definitely have 3 or 4 people in your group not working, and hopefully it's not you. But you begin to understand, well, actually, God, if I apply this outward action to all my relationships, should I be learning how to treat people with fairness, with respect, with compassion, with love? You begin to see, well, actually, this then doesn't just apply to our work or our schools, but even to our friendships, to our churches, to people here. Discovering what it means to actually treat people with the dignity and respect that they need, that they deserve. Character and relationships go a long, long way. It's amazing because actually, when you come out of the work situation, if you are a trustworthy employee and eventually your coworker leaves, but you still keep in touch, that character and relationship breaks out from just being in work, but being into some place where they can share about their life, especially if they need someone to pray for them, to encourage them, or to even offer to bring them to church. For us, I think we're all still too scared to invite people to church. But we got to break out of that. We get to the point where you say, well, actually, but I want them to know about you, God. I hunger for this. I want my life to be involved in other people's lives so that your name can be glorified. The last point is this, actually. Daniel is obedient. He's obedient to God and wherever God desires. Even this choice to not eat, that's part of obedience to God. So let me read on a little bit. In verse 13, at the end of 10 days, see how we look compared to the other young men who are eating the king's food. Then make your decision in light of what you see. The attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nourished than the young men who had been eating the food assigned by the king. So after that, the attendant fed them only vegetables instead of the food and wine provided for the others. I'm not sure how the other students felt about it at this point, but at the end of the day, everyone was eating just vegetables. God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. And God gave Daniel the special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. Does this remind you of anything else? So what happens here is Daniel is faithful in just kind of this food, a small thing, eating. But in the end, everyone's eating the same thing, but Daniel and his friends are given more wisdom, more knowledge. And Daniel is given the ability to interpret visions and dreams. Which eventually, if you follow the story of Daniel, we'll look, Daniel becomes an influential figure in the history of Babylon. In terms of his relationship to the king and to the terms of things that he does for them. In other words, somehow he ends up being a really high flyer. To me, when I read this, it reminded me very much of Matthew 25:23, where the parable of the talents, where at the end, the master returns and he says, what have you done with this 10 talents I've given you? And then the servant comes back and says, I've taken your 10, I've produced 10 more. And then what does the master say? Well done, my good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in handling this small amount, so now I will give you many more responsibilities. Let's celebrate this together. See, Daniel doesn't set out to not eat this food so that somehow God will give him a promotion later. He does it because he just wants to worship God. He wants to be obedient to him. And God sees that obedience, and he multiplies it. And he gives Daniel so much more because he needs to see, look, Daniel, can I trust you? If I can't trust you in the small things, how can I trust you in the big things? For a lot of us, we actually want the big things in our Christian faith. We want to see great things happen. But we have to learn how to be obedient in the small things, the little things, the step-by-steps. And I don't just mean in your lifestyle, but I also mean sometimes when God prompts your heart to talk to someone, to pray for someone, to encourage someone, those small steps are important because God is using those to say, yeah, well, do you trust me? I remember the times where I don't obey God and I really make a mess of it. And those are horrible because they come back and haunt you because you're like, you regret. You think, actually, God, you could have taught me something there, but I was too scared. I was too scared of what people would think. I remember God prompted me once to write an email to a friend to talk to him about, well, I didn't realize it, but I thought God was saying, you know, you should write this email to this friend of yours and just to challenge him about, you know, the area of sexual purity. And I just thought, it's a bit out of the blue, a bit awkward. So I totally didn't do it. And then later, a few weeks later, my friend says, oh, yeah, this guy got into a real big sort of mess. And he immediately, I'm convicted because God was probably wanting to use me to at least challenge him. But I didn't. I chickened out. And those are things which come back and make me realize, yeah, if I'm not obedient in the small things, why would God ever trust me with any more? This week, if you even just say to God, God, I want to be obedient to you in the small things. I want to trust you. And when you speak to me, I want to obey it. This week, pray that prayer, and when he gives you those opportunities, take them. He's not going to ask you immediately to say, oh, I want you to go buy a ticket and fly off to Africa and cure Ebola. Okay, that is a giant step right away. He will test you in small steps first. And if you want, you can check with your friends. I think God's asking me to do this. But sometimes it's immediately at the moment, and you know, I should say something here. I should pray for this person. This week, as you guys know, last week I said, I've not been having as much faith as I have. I've been kind of a chicken. This week, I chickened out again. I was at school. See, I'm just confessing to you. That's okay. I was at school, and then one of the parents was talking to me about a relative who's ill, and I just thought to myself, oh, that's really hard. And then I said to them, okay, I'll be praying for you guys. When really God was saying, just pray for her now. Who cares that it's in the school playground? Nobody cares anyways. You should just pray for her now. But I was like, I'm just going to do the safe Christian thing and just say I'll pray for you at home and maybe I'll remember. I'm too honest, am I? And that was the thing. And then I was immediately struck and convicted to be like, God, I keep blowing these opportunities, God. But we learn to not blow them. We learn to obey. And if you're learning something out of Daniel, this is the big thing. Live your life in obedience to him. Take those risks. Let's pray. God, we thank you because you are just so merciful to us. You know, you don't have to do it this way where you teach us anything. You could just zap it all yourself, and yet your love for us is just so amazing that you choose to teach us, to guide us, to inspire us, to challenge us in these ways. Father God, I pray that your Spirit challenge us all this week, that we discover new opportunities to live in obedience to you, Lord. Stir up that passion in our heart, even as we come to worship you now. Begin speaking and challenging to us, whether it is to come to receive prayer or to pray for someone as well. We thank you in your name, we pray.